Very well. Pardon? Better than normal? That's good. How you doing, Matt? Good? How you doing, Josh? Good?
Pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good or just good?
I'm pretty good. Tired.
Tired?
Yeah.
You are?
Yeah.
How come?
I don't know. I don't think I did too well on a midterm, so that's always kind of annoying.
That's not good.
It's all right.
It's not good. Not good. You know, I always flunk my midterms. You know, I just don't do very well. You know, I don't know why. I just can't compete with you guys. You're too smart for me. You know how that goes. Just let me see what's going on. Nothing coming through.
Oh, you hit.
I played.
Okay.
So why isn't it working?
That's why the video is going. It's at the very beginning of the tape.
Okay,
so
let me do it. Don't make me nervous.
There you go.
Okay, good. Okay, good. They'll get it in a sec. Get some work done, Jessica.
March 31st, 1994.
It's because of him that an innocent man was sent to prison.
He saved my life.
And for that, I'm telling you that it's because of him that we may never again bury war dead with our identities unknown.
Operation Desert Storm was the first war involving hundreds of war dead that nobody had to be buried in the tomb of the unknown soldier.
It's because of him that major breakthroughs have been made in testing for diseases.
The testing for hereditary cancer that we're doing and developing would not be feasible without PCR.
Tonight, it's all because of him, Gary Mullis, and his amazing gene machine.
Reporting from Washington, Ted Koppel.
Take all the MVPs from professional baseball, basketball, and football, throw in a dozen favorite movie stars and half a dozen rock stars for good measure. Add all the television anchor people now on the air,
Mike.
And collectively we have not affected the current good or the future welfare of mankind as much as Carrie Mullis. That's Carrie with a K. Mullis, M-U-L-L-I-S. Chances are significantly better than even that you've never heard the name. But the FBI was able to identify the killer of one of its agents by analyzing the dandruff in a hatband left at the scene of the crime. An American soldier killed in Vietnam was identified after more than a generation by matching the DNA in a lock of his baby hair to that recovered from a bone retrieved in Vietnam. In the future, the FBI expects to identify extortionists by the DNA from their saliva, left on the inside of an envelope. Doctors anticipate repairing genetic damage in fetuses, and all of them will be using a technique developed by Carrie Mullis. In 1993, Mullis won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for his discovery of what he called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. That, in and of itself, should have been reason enough to interest us in Dr. Mullis. But let the truth be told. If Carrie Mullis were not also a surfing, rollerblading eccentric who has been known to enliven his lectures with nude photographs of his girlfriends, he might have escaped our notice. You should also know that we have hired Dr. Mullis as a consultant to work with us on another story having to do with research into the causes of AIDS.
Mike.
We'll be broadcasting that sometime in the near future. But first, we wanted you to meet Carrie Mullis and have him tell you about PCR, the method he discovered for duplicating DNA.
This morning, when I was out there surfing with these guys at the breakout here, they all know I have Nobel Prize winner right now, but they also all know that it doesn't make one damn to the ocean, whether you're a Nobel Prize winner or not. You're treated the same way as everybody else out there. And I ate a lot of salt water with it. I've always been extremely curious, but not in a disciplined sort of way. I've never pursued a particular course of study for very long. I've sort of hopped around from place to place. The first paper I ever published was in astrophysics. It didn't have anything to do with what I was working on at the time. I was a biochemist. But I was interested in astrophysics, and I thought something interesting. I said, well, you know, your ideas here are as good as anybody else's, probably. That's a kind of a strange way to think about a science that's very much specialized and rules. But in fact, you can actually have ideas in other people's fields that are really valuable to them, because they didn't see the stuff that you saw, because they were in their own little narrow discipline. I was real new to DNA chemistry, in fact, when I invented PCR, and I didn't know that it was probably impossible.
History of science that one can pinpoint exactly where and when an important new idea was born. But in the case of PCR, it was this winding stretch of Highway 128 on a Friday night in April of 1983, as Carrie Mullis headed to his weekend place in the Redwood Country of Northern California.
I was dealing with a fairly common goal a lot of people had, that was trying to figure out a way to check and see if a kid is about to be born with a really terrible disease. And a lot of people were trying to figure out how can you quickly do that? How can you simply do it?
There are at least 50 diseases that we now test using PCR.
I was working in a laboratory where we made these real short little pieces of DNA, and I was just thinking about how you go about solving the problem with them.
It's absolutely revolutionized the number of people on Earth who can and do answer interesting scientific questions.
I was thinking of it more like a game, you know, like a puzzle, like toys, like, kind of like Tinker Toys. And I was putting them in various ways in my mind to see if there was any way I could arrange them that would allow me to read a single base pair off of a particular location in the DNA molecule. And I was really enjoying it.
I think it's one of the major scientific advances, certainly of the century.
I got it sort of on my little screen up in front of my face that I had these things arranged that way. That suddenly occurred to me that if I did something which was kind of strange to biochemists at the time, which would have been to repeat this particular process over and over and over again, that it would have an astounding effect, and that it would pull out one little part of a complicated and very lengthy sequence. It would take out one little part of it, and it would amplify that. It would make copies of it over and over again. So you make two copies, then you make four, then you make eight, then you make 16. And if you do a process like that 20 times, you get a million. And if you do it 30 times, you get a billion. What went through my mind was, Eureka, I have just discovered something that's going to make me very famous. And I probably got about half a mile down here and then realized something else. And I just, that was part of the thing. It was not only would it make copies of the DNA that I was interested in, but it would make them all exactly the same size. And that was a real shocking thing, too. It was like two most important problems in DNA chemistry had been solved in the last mile, if it would work.
In his spare time at his lab here at what was then the Cepheus Corporation, Mullis was, within a few months, able to prove that his process worked. But he had trouble getting his colleagues to take the idea seriously.
What really convinced people here that it was a useful technique was when people from outside of Cetus saw it and recognized that it was going to be a really important tool, and then the interest in Cetus picked up quite a bit.
I think that's natural. Scientists are very conservative.
It was James Watson who won the Nobel Prize for describing the structure of DNA who invited Mullis in 1986
to present his discovery at his research center in Cold Spring Harbor, New York.
A number of people sort of came up to the front of the auditorium and surrounded me in a fairly tight little knot of people wanting to know more and more about it. And they obviously were going to take it right back to their labs and start working with it.
On one level, the discovery of PCR was a breathtakingly simple breakthrough. Before PCR, working with DNA was difficult, time-consuming, and required a high level of skill. After PCR, the tiniest, most fragile piece of DNA could be reproduced so quickly and so many times that entire new worlds of research have been opened up.
The most remarkable effect of PCR on science, generally, has been that it has democratized the field.
Oh, I think we thought it was nice. You didn't think it was going to revolutionize the field. But within about 2 years it did. You know, there's more and more people, and you see, boy, how easy it is.
PCR has turned into something of a gold mine. It's estimated that the PCR business will soon be worth more than $1 billion a year for Roche Molecular Systems. They bought the patent from Cetus in 1991 for a record $300 million.
The patent was in my name, but there's two lines on the top of the patent. One is inventor, the other is assigned to. And if you ever have a choice, get your name on the assigned to line. Mine was on the inventor line, so I got the Nobel Prize, and Cetus got $300 million. I'd actually rather have the Nobel Prize than $300 million, but it would probably be a hard choice to make if you're really working for it.
What Cary Mullis got for his discovery was a $10,000 year-end bonus. When we come back, how his discovery is changing all of our lives.
This is ABC News Nightline, brought to you by Intel.
Rarely does a major scientific breakthrough so soon produce results that touch society at large. But that is exactly what happened with the innovation for which Cary Mullis won his Nobel Prize. This one man set off a revolution that has sprung a convicted killer from jail, that is telling parents what genetic diseases their children are likely to develop, and that promises to fix some of those defects. PCR has some unique qualities. It can work with samples of DNA that are very small, very old, and in very bad shape.
Using sophisticated techniques, they extract the preserved blood from the mosquito ant. Bingo.
The premise of last year's blockbuster movie, Jurassic Park, was that dinosaur DNA could be recovered from fossilized insects and used to create living dinosaurs. Making living creatures from old fragments of DNA is still in the realm of science fiction, but the development of PCR has essentially invented a new field of research into ancient DNA. Scientists have successfully extracted DNA from insects trapped in amber 120 million years ago.
There you go.
Teeth from mummies and ancient graves have yielded DNA that can answer fundamental questions.
Very simply, we can learn who we are as a species, how we are related to each other. We can learn how our origins in Africa led to the migrations out of Africa. CCC.
Since certain kinds of DNA are transmitted only from mother to children, these can be compared to find out if people are related to each other. Dr. Mary Claire King has used PCR to identify children kidnapped during the years of military rule in Argentina and reunite them with their families. Bodies found in mass graves have also been identified.
PCR has allowed us to identify the victims of human rights abuses and consequently to prosecute people who have engaged in genocide.
One of the biggest scientific projects underway in the U.S. today is the Human Genome Project, an ambitious attempt to identify the hundreds of thousands of genes that make up human DNA. James Watson was the first director of the multi-billion dollar project.
PCR simply reduced the cost by a factor of 10. You know, we kept saying, well, it'll be new technology, but in fact, key technology.
It was really careless that we didn't realize it was so important.
PCR can also test for the presence of defective genes that have been linked to specific diseases, like certain types of cancer.
The testing for hereditary cancer that we're doing and developing would not be feasible without PCR.
Dr. Alan Bale of Yale University is studying hereditary diseases that are caused by defective genes passed from parents to children.
In the case of adult onset diseases, it's telling people who are young whether or not they're going to develop the disease later. That's introduced a certain amount of controversy into this testing because many people might not want to know whether they're going to develop the disease if there's nothing you can do to alter the course of that disease.
Even an unborn fetus can be examined within weeks of conception to see if it has defective genes. Constance English has a teenage son who is retarded. She recently found it was the result of an inherited genetic disorder called Fragile X syndrome.
I love my son desperately, but maybe at the beginning of this, I've chosen not to have children. Not for ourselves, but because life is so hard for him. I think it's a very difficult decision to make.
The next step in genetic medicine is to treat hereditary diseases by implanting good genes to enhance defective ones. Dr. Ronald Crystal is a pioneer in this new field of gene therapy.
Without PCR, this field would never be a reality today, and it would have taken years and years to develop.
Crystal also sees the possibility of correcting genetic defects in unborn children.
We can look forward to the future where we could genetically repair an embryo as well. We can't do that today, but there is no reason that in the future that those technologies will not be developed.
Another field being turned upside down by PCR is that of criminal forensics. The FBI has been using DNA analysis in criminal work for years now, but Mullis's work is lending it new precision.
Because PCR technology allows us to improve our sensitivity of samples that we deal with, it will become virtually impossible, I believe, for an individual to be involved in a crime and not somehow leave some trace behind that might be typable using PCR technology, some trace of hair, tissue, body fluid that can be used subsequently to identify the perpetrator of the crime.
Kurt Bloodsworth traps muskrats for a living on Maryland's Eastern Shore. In August of 1984, he was charged with the brutal rape and murder of this 9-year-old girl. He was convicted twice and spent 9 years in prison, two of them on death row.
I slept right on top of the head. And for a man to come from the country and be somewhere he didn't belong was an awful experience, to say the least.
Testing on the girl's panties had been inconclusive. Bloodsworth had been reading up in jail on these new developments and had his lawyer send the panties to a small lab that specialized in the new PCR technique.
They gave us the result back, and they told me that I was 100% excluded as the person who's positive semen.
In short order, the FBI confirmed the tests, and Bloodsworth was released.
Set me free. Set me free. I'm standing out here, the ducks are flying, the geese are flying. I'm doing what I want to do in life. I used to dream about this stuff. I like to have a cocktail with my mom and thank him. I don't know where he thought of that at or how he come up with it. I tell you, he saved my life. And for that, I'm eternally grateful.
When we come back, Carrie Mullis on the ethical implications of PCR. Carrie Mullis and his innovation of PCR have helped put science, particularly genetics, on fast forward. The rapid advances it makes possible are both controversial and troubling. Bioethicists are people who wrestle with the ethical and moral implications of this work for society, and PCR is giving them plenty to think about. Mullis has his own views on the subject. True to form, they are unorthodox and controversial. We spoke with him at his cabin in Northern California.
I think they're happening much too fast already. Our ability to absorb change, technological change,
is much less than our ability to cause it right now.
Of course, Mullis is himself responsible for a lot of that rapid change.
Bioethicists are kind of a consequence of PCR, because PCR has accelerated the rate at which we can look at genes, and we can analyze them, figure out what they are, we can move them around, change them, we can manipulate them. And the bioethicists are the guys that are, you know, rising up out of the woodwork somewhere and saying, ah, before we do this, we better check into the ethics of it. And basically, I think bioethicists could probably be better off being writers or something. I don't think we need bioethicists. There's some class of person would be trained in order to answer really basic questions about ethics. I don't think everyone is equally capable of understanding those kinds of things.
PCR provides the ability to genetically look into someone's future. It can tell, for instance, if a newly conceived fetus will develop a genetic disease. Not everyone would want to know. Again, Mullis has his own point of view.
That is a very good thing to know, and I think the kind of person that you want to talk to at that point in your life, if you happen to be in that situation, is not a bioethicist, but somebody who's experienced that disease in their life, or somebody's mother who's watched her kid grow up to the age of 17 and die with muscular dystrophy. Ask her whether she thinks she should abort it or not. I think a bioethicist is really kind of a worthless kind of a person to have around. It's not really all that much an ethical decision in the sense of a philosophic kind of thing. It's a personal, emotional thing. Do you feel so strongly about the fact that you want this life to come into being that you don't mind the fact that it may suffer a lot? And then you make your decision yourself. It's not a public decision, I think it's a private decision. It's a damn serious decision.
As I said at the beginning of the program, Kerry Mullis is an eccentric, rarely accused of holding back on his opinion of the world. I'll be back with some closing thoughts about him in a moment. Many years ago, a whimsical comedy writer by the name of Alan Sherman acquired a modest degree of fame writing and performing some funny songs. But I've always remembered something he wrote in an article for TV Guide. Television, said Sherman, makes prisoners of us all by paying us more than we're worth. Kerry Mullis, who's in a totally different line of work, seems to have understood that rather profound lesson. When you allow money to become too important in your life, you begin to worry about not offending the people who pay you. After a while, not offending evolves into not disagreeing. That mindset has destroyed more than one creative career, but in the field of science, it can be fatal. Kerry Mullis has it right. The money really is less important than the freedom to go wherever your ideas may take you. That's our report for tonight. I'm Ted Koppel in Washington. For all of us here at ABC News, good.
If you wish a printed transcript of this or any Nightline broadcast, please send $5 to
quite a remarkable guy and quite a remarkable invention. And I think that Ted Koppel had it absolutely correct. And that is that sometimes people make impacts on people and society that far outweigh the $14 million a year contracts that the basketball and baseball and football players get. Sometimes these people worked like Mullis did his whole life for $50,000 a year, $60,000 a year, and come up with these really incredible breakthroughs that really affect all of our lives. And I'm going to come back to that theme in a bit. What I'd like to do is pick up where I left off last week. We were talking about the replication of DNA, and it should be obvious now that I was leading into the replication of DNA because I wanted to transition into the polymerase chain reaction, and I wanted to transition into human diseases. As I said on Thursday, the polymerase chain reaction really It just revolutionized everything. And I can't say that enough. It changed the way we work with DNA, changed the way we diagnose disease, changed the way we do practically everything. And so it was a monumental, absolutely monumental breakthrough, and it led to a lot of philosophical insights, as Mary King said, in terms of how we became who we are and everything else. But the bottom line is really that it led to a lot of really novel and fundamental major breakthroughs in our understanding of human diseases, in our understanding of genes. And in fact, without the polymerase chain reaction, without that remarkable technique, the human genome would have never been sequenced, nor would the genomes of any other organism be sequenced. And therefore, this marvelous collection and resource and incredible numbers of major breakthroughs would have never been made without the polymerase chain reaction. So let me go backwards and just talk conceptually about a few of the things that you've heard about in the class, a few of the things that you've had in discussion. Let me review a few of these things and then end this little discourse on how genes work in 30 or 40 minutes with a big bang, a really big bang. I think the microphone went out. You got it? Up a little? There you go. Thank you. And what I want to do is finish with a really big bang. As I said on last Thursday, I think when I tell you about this little bang, your eyes are going to pop out, because I'm going to conclude this little vignette in how genes work with a little bit of a story that'll take just a few minutes. But when I show you this story, it's going to make everything that you saw with respect to altering the body plan of a fly when the eye was grown on the knee of the fly, what I'm going to show you in about 40 minutes, makes that to be child play. Because I'm going to show you something even more astonishing that you can do with genetic engineering. But before I show you that, I have to tell you something about it so that you can understand the basis of it. So let me continue. As you know, from the beginning of class, I talked about genetic variation. And I said that genetic variation is the basis of everything, and that genetic variation really was the substance upon which the early biotechnologists, our ancestors, were really working with in order to develop all of the crop plants that we have, develop all of the animals that we have and we use and we eat. Could you leave it exactly where it was before for me, please? Thank you. I think that that's good. And then I don't have to strain my voice. So I think that genetic variation, which arises through spontaneous mutation, is really the basis of everything in this room, how we look different, how we do everything differently. And so it's important to talk a little bit about this variation. It's a little bit important to talk about where it came from. It's important to talk about the basis of these mutations in order to understand it. Mutations arise spontaneously during the replication of DNA. They're very rare events. As I said last Thursday, the DNA polymerase that copies the DNA is almost 100% perfect, but it's not 100% perfect. In fact, there can be errors that occur. And the errors that occur is not due to the enzyme itself. The errors that occur during DNA replication is simply because spontaneously, and I'm not going to go into the chemistry of this, spontaneously, sometimes instead of an A pairing with a T, sometimes that A can pair with a G, or sometimes that A can pair with a C. And so there can be spontaneous mistakes in the pairing during the replication process between a purine pairing with a pyrimidine, which you know it really rarely ever takes place, or a purine pairing with the wrong purine, which rarely takes place. And when this happens, the DNA chain, rather than having an AT at its particular position, will now have, let's say, an AC at that particular position. And that C invokes a change. because when this strand replicates, this A will now pair normally with a T, but when that strand replicates, that C will now pair normally with a G, because the mistake is very rare. It occurs only 1 out of 1 million to 1 out of 1 billion times, very, very, very rare, but it's due to a mistake in base pairing. And so what I'm saying is that mutations are not due to the fact that this little machine, this DNA polymerase, is defective, quite the contrary. The mistakes are simply due spontaneously to the chemistry of the bases, and the hydrogen bonds that allow one base to be complementary to another base. And sometimes those spontaneously induced mismatching, it's called mismatching, or mispairing, sometimes that spontaneously induced mispairing will give rise to a mutation. It's very rare, but it occurs, and it only occurs, and I'm going to say this again, because of the chemistry of the bases. And sometimes the chemistry changes spontaneously so that an A can pair with a G, or an A can pair with a C, or a G can pair with a T, perfectly normal, perfectly stable, perfectly permissible, but very rare because the chemistry changes spontaneously in these bases. And when that happens, as you can see in this overhead, when that happens, you get a mutation. In other words, the sequence of the nucleotides in a particular gene or in a particular spot of the DNA doesn't have to be in a gene. In fact, most of the mutations that occur don't really occur in genes in the human genome, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But clearly, we can have an AT base pair that can mispair with a C, and now after replication, this C, the next daughter strand, has a GC, so we've gone from an AT base pair to a GC base pair. If, and only if, that results in a change in a functional protein, it will lead to a change in the phenotype, and if it is in a gene, in let's say the human genome, that's extremely important, it can lead to a very serious disease because the protein function has been changed. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a second when I talk just briefly about proteins. And clearly then, these are manifested, at least in human populations or in plant populations or in anything, because the phenotype pops up. And so way back when these mutations were first manifested in human populations, some serious disease resulted, like, for example, hemophilia, which we're going to talk about a little bit later today, or some other thing which may be lethal or cause very serious problems with someone in a particular family. And a mutation was recognized in the old days and still is by a very dramatic change in the phenotype of, again, a human being or a plant or a fly or whatever. And then these mutations were then traced once people understood the laws of genetics. They were traced from generation to generation to generation, and they were followed because of the phenotype of the individuals that had, in this case, both copies of a defective gene. But they result ultimately from these spontaneous mutations. And these disease genes in humans can arise over and over and over and over and over again spontaneously, which means if you go back to the first week when we talked about eugenics, the idea of removing a gene from a human population is ridiculous, because even if you remove the gene, by some method, it's going to reappear again, because all these things occur over and over again spontaneously. And furthermore, if the gene is recessive, the gene exists in populations mostly in carriers, unidentified carriers. And therefore, even if you can identify the individuals in the old days that were afflicted and had two copies of this gene, you wouldn't be able to identify the carriers. Now we can, of course. And therefore, to prevent these people, as we talked about earlier, from reproducing or anything else in terms of negative genetics is really bad genetics, because you're not going to remove these genes from the population because mostly they exist in carriers, as you can see over here. And furthermore, you can't get rid of them because they reappear by spontaneous mutation. So this whole notion of negative eugenics is really an ill-conceived type notion. Sam, take the microphone.
Question. So if the mutations are spontaneous, does that mean that there's new new mutations occurring?
Yes.
Like there will be mutations that have not yet, so there will be sort of always new diseases and genetic...
Well, there probably won't be new diseases because every mutation that could ever exist in any human disease gene has already occurred.
So
and so there's so much genetic variation in populations that new things probably won't arise that we hadn't seen before.
Why do they have to have
not
already
why,
happened
it's
again?
Not the appropriate question.
What is the reason that... What is the explanation for?
For?
The fact that every mutation, as you said, has already been
because
seen or already happened.
Think about how many generations of humans there have been or how many generations of plants or bacteria they've been. And if the mutation frequency is 1 in 10 to the 6th, that means every million times the DNA replicates, a spontaneous mutation can occur. And in fact, when we look at the human genome and we compare individuals, okay, so I compare, for example, your DNA to my DNA, we find a difference in a nucleotide between you, Sam, and me every 300 bases. So those are due to just spontaneous mutations that are occurring over the generations, and let's say your ancestors, my ancestors, your parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, etc. So therefore, these mutations are occurring all the time spontaneously. And therefore, no new disease is going to pop up. You might recognize something as a new disease that you didn't recognize before because you have better diagnostic tools or something, but there's only so many genes in the genome to mutate, and those have existed for hundreds and hundreds and millions of years. And therefore, you're not going to be able to create something new that hadn't been there before. Maybe it hadn't been recognized, but it's there.
So just at some point in the life, the survival of a species or the history of a species, there's like a saturation point, not a saturation point, but a point to reach where all the combinations or all the mutations would have occurred?
Yes, the question, yeah, very good. So the point is that every single solitary nucleotide in a genome, I'm very simplifying, has an equal chance of being mutated as well as anything else. That's not exactly correct because there's local selection pressures and all those other kinds of things, but in a simplistic sense, yes. And that's what you see when you start looking at genomes and start sequencing. You know, if we sequenced all of our genomes in here, we'd start seeing all kinds of nucleotide differences, and those are simply due to spontaneous mutations. We're going to talk a lot about that towards the end of the quarter. Okay? So we have these mutations. And we've talked about using these mutations as markers. We've talked about using these mutations as markers in discussion and in lecture. We've talked about markers as simply, you know, tall and short peas. That's a marker for height. We've talked about markers in terms of yellow tomatoes and red tomatoes. The color of a tomato fruit is a marker. We've talked about molecular markers, restriction fragment link polymorphisms that I'm going to allude to again today. We've talked about all kinds of markers, and those markers are simply markers of mutations, markers of genetic variability, markers ultimately of the process by which mutations occur. Now, when we consider a human disease and a human disease gene, consider the fact that that disease is due to a mutation in a particular gene that's very important for an extremely vital process. And for those of you that have read that Scientific American article that I gave you called Founder Mutations, you'll know that for most genes, mutations can occur anywhere in the gene, and they can occur over and over and over and over again in different places. And so therefore, if it's a disease gene, the situation is that in any given family, the mutation causing that particular disease could be in a different place of the gene. I'll say that again. For most disease genes, the mutation giving rise to that disease allele can occur anywhere in that gene spontaneously, and therefore in different families, like in Sam's family or in my family or in Josh's family, if there was that particular disease allele, it probably arose because of mutation in a different part of that gene. Now, that makes diagnostics almost impossible, because that means the diagnostics have to be on a family-by-family basis, because any one marker that you would have would be different for that mutation in different families. That's absolutely critical. And so what you would want to have in that situation, if you could, was a linked marker. In other words, something outside the gene that might be always linked to that particular allele. And that's how one would do it. And you have to find those linked markers, and you know a little bit about that. And that makes, again, using, and I'll come back to this in a second, that makes finding these markers very, very, very difficult and very challenging. And in some cases, with some cases of hemophilia and other kinds of diseases, finding the marker almost becomes impossible because of different and different families. On the other hand, there are those diseases in which the mutation occurs spontaneously in what is called a hotspot. A hotspot. But for what some reason, and some reason alone, and probably due to, well, a lot of things that I don't want to get into, that mutation would occur in this gene in exactly the same place, what would be called a hot spot, meaning exactly the same nucleotide was mutated or exactly the same region every single solitary time. Or at least the mutation in that region was selected for every single solitary time. Doesn't necessarily mean it occurred in that position every single time, but at least there was some selection pressure to select for that particular mutation. So we can have a hot spot, and in that case, the marker in the hot spot can be used always to diagnose that disease gene. Because every time someone has that particular disease gene, it's going to be the same defect, the same nucleotides, the same restriction site altered, the same something altered, and no matter what family it arises in spontaneously, no matter where it occurs spontaneously, it's going to be the same thing. And of course, that takes a lot of research to try and figure that one out. The second possibility is we have a founder effect. A founder effect, meaning way back in time, in some ancient family, let's say of mine, or my ancient relatives, there was a mutation in a particular human gene, and that mutation occurred in a particular spot, and that mutation had some adaptive significance, meaning it conferred some advantage to my ancestors or me or my parents, grandparents, or whatever. And therefore, this one mutation, the same mutation, was maintained and conserved through eons and eons and eons of time. And the classic example of that is sickle cell anemia. There's been founder mutations in African populations which have been maintained for thousands and thousands and thousands of years in those populations because in the heterozygous situation, in carriers, the presence of a sickle cell allele protects those individuals from malaria. Now, those founder mutations can occur spontaneously in different lineages, but once they occur, they tend to be maintained in those lineages if there's a selective pressure. If there's no selective pressure, then they're lost because, in fact, they would have a selective disadvantage. In a situation where you don't have malaria, if you'd have sickle cell anemia, it's not exactly something which is advantageous. Only when there's a selective pressure. So we have hot spots that can occur because the mutation is just occurring over and over and over again, but in the same place. So therefore, you'd be able to use that place as a diagnostic marker. Or we have founder mutations, and the founder mutation occurred once, and then it's maintained in a population. And therefore, because it occurs once, it occurs throughout that population, and where that mutation occurs can be used as a marker molecularly using DNA technology. And furthermore, founder mutations are very useful for tracing lineages. There's all kinds of founder mutations we'll talk about later on in the quarter. Some of them have no effect on phenotype, but they're very good for tracing our lineages and where we came from. But the classic example of founder mutations, cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia, and there's a whole bunch of others. So what am I saying? This is a very important principle. Most mutations occur highly spontaneously in human genes. Most mutations occur anywhere in the human gene. It can be in the switch. It can be in the body of the gene. Anything in the gene, and I'm going to come back to that, this is important for the functioning of a gene, can lead to the lack of the production, Jordan, of a functional protein. That means anything from transcription to translation to post-translation, and I'll review that in a few minutes. Anything that disrupts that process and eliminates a functional protein can cause a mutation. And those mutations in most genes can occur anywhere in the gene and can occur over and over and over again. And if they're in the same gene, they'll obviously sometimes lead to the same phenotype. On the other hand, and this you don't have because I cut it out, but you have the article. This is from that Founder Mutation Scientific American article that I gave you. On the other hand, you can have mutations in a very specific place, right over here, in all of the genes, either due to a hot spot or due to the fact that it occurred as a founder and was perpetuated in the population. And if that change leads to a change in the protein, as it does in the case of sickle cell anemia, and if it has certain selective pressure, which it does in the case of sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis or a variety of others, it's going to be perpetuated. The same mutation is going to be perpetuated, the same mutation, for eons. And you can identify that by a variety of ways. And it can be used as a diagnostic marker to diagnose individuals that are carriers, or more interesting, perhaps, it can be used to determine, as I said, ancestry and where people and groups came from. Now, I'm getting a little bit ahead of the game, and I'm not going to go into this because we're going to go into it in about 2 or 3 weeks. The region around which this marker mutation is inherited is not simply one gene or one nucleotide. The region around that gene generally has a few other markers associated with it, as you can see in this diagram. And those other markers are also inherited as a unit. What I'm saying is that the region around this founder mutation has other differences that are always associated with it. And that's called a haplotype. Haplotype. Very important word. Haplotype. In other words, a haplotype is simply a series of identification markers. Identification markers that are associated with a particular allele, with a particular chromosome. And those haplotype markers are always inherited with that region of the chromosome or with that chromosome forever. Because they're so close, they can't, recombination exchange can't occur, and they're never broken up. And these haplotypes and these markers are fascinating because they can be used to trace lineages. Because where they occurred was basically a founder effect. And so if you want to trace lineages of groups of populations, you know, in Africa or in Europe or in Asia, whatever, you follow these haplotypes. And in fact, a part of the Human Genome Project, which is going on right now, is to map haplotypes in every population on the face of this earth. And the significance of this is that every group, and every group that has a particular ancestry, and I don't care where they come from or how local, will have specific haplotypes. And once the haplotype map of human beings is created, and the haplotype map is now being created from a mixture of DNA from individuals of about 20 to 40 different ancestries and ethnic persuasions and, quote, races, if we can consider a race, and I'm going to come back to that in a couple of weeks, all mixed together to get a haplotype that maps the chromosomes of every single group on the face of this earth. And once that's done, we're going to be able to trace the lineages of almost everybody and where they came from and what their origins are. And it's simply because of these spontaneous mutations. But in the case of disease genes, it's very, very, very powerful because you have diagnostic markers because we have a founder mutation, and those founder mutations are in the exact same place, the exact same gene, went back thousands and millions of years ago, and that marker can be used now to trace that particular gene. So, for example, Cystic fibrosis, 70% of all the mutations in cystic fibrosis genes are in exactly the same place, 70% of them, because this particular allele was a founder allele that originated someplace in Northern Europe thousands of years ago. And why? I'm not going to go into what the cystic fibrosis protein is, other than the fact that it serves to conduct ions across membranes. It's very important for transporting particular kinds of things across intestinal membranes and other things. And they think that the selection pressure on this particular cystic fibrosis allele is due to the fact that in a carrier situation, it protects the individuals from diarrhea. And that was very important in Europe during the Middle Ages, where, you know, you had all kinds of very serious diseases that caused diarrhea, typhoid and cholera and a variety of other kinds of things. And individuals that were carrying a mutant form of the cystic fibrosis gene might have been protected against those effects more than individuals that carried both copies of a normal allele. And what you can see here is that I'm not going to go into this thing called ASO. You'll know all about this ASO procedure for your final oral exam in this class. I'm not going to talk very much about it. But what you can see is this mutation always occurs here. In 70% of the cases, it's a 3-base pair deletion in a particular exon, and that changes the amino acid sequence of the protein, and you can have very nice diagnostic markers here. And I'm not going to go into exactly what this means now. I'll go into it later. But there's a normal, there's a heterozygote, and there's a mutant. Very nice markers for those particular founder mutations. Furthermore, sickle cell anemia. Again, it's a founder mutation. That founder mutation occurs always in this exact same place, always in this particular nucleotide, an A to a T. That's because when those mutations arise, they stay in those populations because of the selective pressure that I've talked about. That's a particular loss of a restriction site. And what you can see is that we have normals, we have carriers, and we have heterozygotes. And you can use that as a very nice polymorphic marker in a variety of other things. Now, the future, in the article I gave you again in Scientific American, Genomes for All, the future is that these markers will be obsolete. You won't need these markers anymore. Because as DNA sequencing becomes cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, as long as you have cloned the gene and sequenced it once, if you have very cheap methods of sequencing, you just sequence the person's DNA right in the clinical lab. And you do it cheaply and rapidly. You give some blood. People sequence the DNA and they say, oh yeah, there's been a mutation in this gene or a mutation in the other gene, and it's very helpful. And so what's going to happen is that all of this marker technology 10, 15, 20, 25 years from now become a thing of the past. And what will be used will be actual sequencing directly of genes or whole genomes, and we'll get whole profiles of genes and alleles, and we'll know who are carriers for things and who are not. And it'll become rapid, fast, cheap, and very doable. And so I think that's what the future is. And therefore, if you suspect that you have, in a certain family, because of your ancestry, hemophilia, you won't need to hunt for a marker using the techniques that are crude, which you've been learning about in this class, but you'll just be able to sequence the DNA from individuals in your family, and let's say sequence the globin gene, which is the gene which is responsible for hemophilia, and be able to say, yes, there's a critical mutation, that mutation's in your family, and now we have to be careful in terms of deciding what we're going to do with that information, but it's going to be because of sequencing of these genomes. So again, just to summarize, this variation, which is the raw material for everything, whether it's human beings, whether it's plants, whether it's bacteria, as you'll see on your take-home test, which you'll have to write about, whether it's whatever, this variation is essential because it's the variation which allows populations to survive. Without genetic variation, we would not be here by any stretch of the imagination because we wouldn't be able to adapt to different circumstances, but all of this occurs spontaneously by different mutations. Now, there's different forms in which mutations can occur. And it's important that you recognize this. It's not simply due to mispairing. That's one form of mutation. But mutations can occur due to all kinds of different things. The bottom line is anything that mucks up the sequence of a gene and is inherited from generation to generation, anything will result in a change of a phenotype and will result in a mutation. Sam, the vast majority of mutations in your genome are not recognizable. 99.9% of all the mutations in human DNA in the human genome cause no phenotypic effect. The only way you can find them is by DNA sequencing. It's only the small numbers in genes, but not just in genes, but in the coding sequence of genes that can result in a change in a functional protein. And remember I said, only if it's change in a functional protein do you result in a mutation. If there's a change in a protein and it doesn't cause any problem with the function, you don't see the mutation. So it's only a small portion, an infinitesimally small portion of these mutations that give rise to any perceptible difference in the phenotype. But of course, those are the things that we see. Those are the things that we grab onto. Those are the things that we, you know, in the case of plants, we select for. In the case of animals, we select for. In the case of humans, these are the things that cause such massive tragedy. A mutation in one gene that's responsible for controlling cell division in a pancreas leads to pancreas cancer, of which, God forbid, someone gets it, the person is dead within 3 months. There's absolutely no cure. None. Zero. One mutation in one gene. But you see that. Of course, that mutation generally is not inherited. It just occurs spontaneously during the lifespan of an organism. And generally, it occurs as someone gets older, because the chances of mutation in that gene are greater over time. And the reason why we see a higher incidence of cancer, for a variety of reasons, but one of the primary reasons is we're getting older. We're living longer, and so therefore we can see them. One mutation in one gene. So Sam, we see that, and it causes a tragedy, but all the other mutations don't cause any effect, and we don't care about them except for tracing our ancestry and all kinds of good science, but it has no perceptible effect. A mutation in one gene that specifies a protein that is important in your brain that is important for making fats in your brain turn over, a mutation in that one gene, that one nucleotide change, can cause a very beautiful, healthy, wonderful, smiling, incredible young baby die a horrible death by age 3, like Tay-Sachs. One gene. We see that, Sam, because that causes a change in a functional protein, leading to lasting, horrible, depressing situations. And so we're concerned about these disease genes because we see them. It causes tragic, tragic kinds of things. But those mutations can occur spontaneously in a variety of ways. And how can they occur just conceptually? Well, the first thing is that they can occur by what I just told you was a base pair mutation. They can occur simply by a mispairing during the replication. As I said, an A pairing with a C, a T pairing with a G pairing with an A, spontaneously because of the chemistry. But it also can occur in your lungs if you smoke cigarettes, because probably one of the most potent mutagens that there is cigarette smoke, and a variety of other things. And so the incidence of lung cancer is directly proportional to the incidence of smoking. And that's because environmental chemicals also have the ability to alter your nucleotides and alter the pairing. So mutations can occur spontaneously, or they can be chemically induced. And they can be chemically induced by these things called mutagens, which are mostly also carcinogens. And cigarette smoke is one of the most potent carcinogens. And if any of you smoke, Having lost both of my parents to lung cancer, I know what a horrible disease it is and what a horrible death it is. And I hope, and I'm editorializing, that if any of you in this room smoke, you'll deposit your cigarettes in the wastebasket and never do it again, because it's one of the most horrendous things that anyone could ever go through. And editorializing even further, it's not maybe so horrible for you, but it's horrible for the people that you leave behind. And so keep that in mind if you're taking those cigarettes into your lungs or anything else. That was just an editorial on a side. So we have base pair mutations due to spontaneous or due to chemicals, but we have other kinds of things. One thing that I just alluded to before are these things called insertions or deletions. And what I mean by that is that sometimes during the replication process spontaneously, we can add an extra base. Or sometimes during the replication of the process, we can delete a particular base. And so not always is mutation caused by this base pair change. Sometimes it's called by the insertion of one or a few bases or the deletion of one or a few bases. And the founder mutation for cystic fibrosis is the deletion of three nucleotides. So you can have deletions, you can have additions. But in addition, you can have all kinds of other things. You can have what are called rearrangements. Small ones and big ones. Small ones and big ones. In other words, you can take a piece of DNA, hunk it out of the chromosome, flip it over, and put it back in. If you did that, Editha, what do you think would happen? If I took this gene and I just flipped it like that, what do you think would happen? What do you think would happen?
If you just took the gene and flipped it over?
Yeah.
It would, I don't think it would transcribe properly because it wouldn't be on the set.
Two strands, it's going both over.
Oh,
double
right.
Strands going both over.
Then I don't think anything bad would
possible,
happen.
But what else could, but what possibly could happen? T?
A different, would it connect? Because like the different ends, so.
So you're asking a question, but I'm asking you to answer a question.
It's not
you can't answer
connect.
A question with what would happen.
It's not going to connect back?
Well, yeah, you take it out and you stick it back in.
But then the ends won't match.
Ends of what?
The sticky ends? They're the bases?
I haven't talked anything about sticky ends.
Sorry.
I mean, we're not talking about restriction enzymes here. We're just talking about DNA going out and coming back in. Happens all the time. What do you think would happen? Editha said nothing, which is one possibility. But what else could happen? Samantha?
The gene could be regulated differently.
Why?
Because the areas of DNA surrounding it affect when it's active.
Exactly. You could put it next to a different switch. In fact, a gene that causes a particular kind of cancer, many genes that cause cancer, that's exactly what happens. They get popped out of a chromosome, and they get popped back in the wrong position, and therefore they start to be regulated differently because now they're hooked up to a different switch. And that switch might not be as controlled as the previous switch. What else could happen, Samantha? What if it's just part of the gene you take out and flip over?
Well, then the part, it would that part
Go ahead.
That got moved would be missing? Or
yeah,
would be...
part of the thing that you moved is missing now and added to something else. And what could happen to that gene in which you add it to?
Well, that one would be messed up too. Because
yeah, so now you get two mutations. And that's another way in which cancer can form, because sometimes hunks of genes from one gene go into another gene and they make a third gene that never existed before, and those can cause some really serious problems. So not only can you have base pair mutations, you can have additions, you can have deletions, you can have rearrangements, things coming out and going back in. And when they come out and go back in, they can either go back in the same place or they can go to a different place. Same chromosome or a different chromosome. And those are called transpositions. So if they come out and they go to another chromosome, it's a transposition, and generally that kind of transposition is called a translocation, going from one chromosome to another chromosome. Or you can have a transposition which takes the piece of DNA out, puts it exactly back in the same position it was, but it's now inverted. And that causes all kinds of serious problems because if it's within the gene, then the genetic code can't be read in the normal way. or it could be next to a different switch, or something can happen in a weird way. The point here is that it's a miracle that the genome is transmitted faithfully from generation to generation, because it's all of these things that can happen to muck it up. Base pair mutations, deletions, insertions, translocations, moving a piece of DNA from one chromosome to another, inversions, taking a piece of DNA and flipping its sequence and putting it back in. All of those things occur. And in fact, they occur at a very high frequency. They occur at such a high frequency that you will learn probably next week, well, I know next week for sure, and I'm going to emphasize it again, that 15% of all spontaneous conceptions in human beings are aborted spontaneously. And the reason why they're aborted spontaneously is because of these mutations that occur that change all kinds of different things in the genome. So they're not as infrequent as we think. Spontaneous mutations, Sam, are pretty infrequent, but moving these hunks of DNA around are a little bit more frequent than we would like. However, they're selected out of our populations because when hunks, big hunks of DNA are moved, embryos don't develop because most of the genes have to be balanced in a very specific way. Yuditha.
I've heard of a thing called a frame shift mutation, and I wasn't sure what that was.
Let's skip that because I think it's way too specific for what we're dealing with. And it would deal with deletions and additions and changing how the genetic code is read. But we can talk about that after class or some other place. It's a little too specific. So here we have inborn errors of metabolism. These inborn errors of metabolism are caused by mutations in genes that affect critical metabolic processes. These are the things that Garrod talked about. These are the things that the early eugenicists at the beginning of the 20th century wanted to get rid of from populations. And these are the things that really caused some very serious, horrible, devastating, depressing situations in human populations. It's never fun. Quite the contrary, to have any of these kinds of mutations in any family or in any individual that you love and you care about. And ultimately, the goal, obviously, is to try and correct them in some way or diagnose them before they cause any problems or prevent children from having them in a variety of different ways. Now, as I said, and I'm repeating myself, but I'm just going to go over this quickly, you can trace these mutations by using these pedigrees. By looking at the phenotype, and you know this from your discussion and your quizzes, you'll know it again from your take-home test. This happens to be hemophilia due to a particular kind of gene on the X chromosome that I'm going to talk so much about in a few minutes that you're going to get tired of it. But the point is you can trace them phenotypically, or as I said, if you have a marker, either in the gene or linked to the gene 100%, you can use that marker either in the process that you've learned, restriction fragment length polymorphisms, that is the length of the DNA fragments, or using the polymerase chain reaction, or whatever. Nick. Where's your handout, Nick? I know you cannot remember all these fascinating things that I'm telling you. Where is your handout? Did you throw it out?
No.
Would you like to borrow mine?
I was curious, in modern science, have we ever been able to identify...
What's your question?
...a positive mutation. So what is that? And if we haven't, then what does that say about, like, the likelihood of evolution?
Well, sickle cell anemia is a positive mutation in certain populations because it gives a selective advantage to those individuals that are carrying that gene. Prevents them from getting malaria, so that would be considered, in your sense, a positive mutation because those individuals that have that particular mutation survive, malaria and others don't. So one could consider that to be positive. Cystic fibrosis in an individual that's carrying that allele in a population that's plagued with cholera will survive, whereas those individuals that don't have it will die. So in that situation, it can be caused positive. So I would say there's no such thing as positive or negative. I think that it's just what it is. And under certain circumstances, I think some things could have a positive selection effect, or under most circumstances, these mutations have negative selection effect, but you have to take it on a situation-by-situation basis.
Yeah, it was just a question because some people that criticize like evolution, they said they've never been able to point out a mutation where it's like, you know, that goes from, you know, a monkey to a man, you know, like that it makes them bipedal. Or,
well, let them look at the sequence of the monkey genome and the human genome, and you'll see a lot of positive mutations. Because we're not monkeys. So therefore, something positive had to happen to allow you to pick up that microphone in this class. And that something positive that had to happen is in your genes.
So have we pinpointed any of those?
Well, I think that's coming. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. Sam.
Okay, so you talked about how founder mutations have to all have, at some point, a positive...
By definition, a founder mutation has to have some adaptive significance to that population.
Okay, so hypothetically, if prenatal testing became widespread and people stopped having children, or fertilizing eggs that possessed this founder gene, right, the founder mutation, like for sickle cell anemia, is there a potential that that founder gene could be removed from the population? And
no,
in that case...
Because it'll reappear again.
It would reappear again, okay.
But the thing is, if there's no selection pressure, like in Europe, it's meaningless. Then it becomes deleterious to have it.
And then it no
so
longer has the
So
in advantage.
The old days, when it came up thousands of years ago, there might have been some positive selection pressure, but now that's gone. Now it's a negative thing. Don't want to have someone with cystic fibrosis. I mean, they live to 30 to 40 now, but in the old days, they lived to be 20 to 25. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible disease. It's terrible. I mean, it affects every part of your body. And so without that positive selection, of which thousands of years ago people only lived to be 25, 30, or 40 years old at the most, those things would have no adaptive significance.
So can the adaptive significance stop? It can become outdated or...
Well, yeah, if the conditions don't exist that there's an adaptive value, then it becomes either neutral or has a negative deleterious effect. And so that's that in a natural, quote, population, where you're just dealing with natural things and we're not altering anything, that would be the ideal situation. But we don't live under those conditions, and we haven't for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Okay, so now let me turn the topic then. I said that in order to have a mutation in a human disease gene that we see as a phenotype, Betty, the protein has to be changed, okay? The protein has to be changed with respect to function. Now, I haven't said really anything about proteins in this class, and I really haven't said anything about how genes are functioning in this class. And so let me just review for Anton. Let me just review a little bit about how genes work and show you how mutations can change the ability of these genes to work and cause these disease genes. But more than that, I want to give you a punchline, and I'm going to get ahead of myself. The punchline is, Heather, that genetic engineering can work because everything in a gene to make it work is modular. It's like a Lego. And therefore, because everything that makes a gene work is like a Lego, you can reconstruct new genes, new combinations of genes, and get them to work in different ways. Because everything is controlled by a sequence, and those sequences are the Legos. And if you know what those sequences are, you can do anything you want. And in a few minutes, I'm going to show you something pretty spectacular. So let me just review for you just conceptually. We have this gene, and we have this gene that's double-stranded. We have the sense strand, which is this, which is the coding strand, and we have the transcribe strand. So we have the sense strand, that happens to be the transcribe strand, and you know that the gene has to be able to be manifested itself. Gene has to be expressed. Where are you going, Betty? So the gene expresses itself by producing this functional protein. And when that protein is defective, it leads to some process that's defective, and it leads to some manifestation of something or some horrible disease. So the gene has, as I'll tell you about in more detail that you want to know in about 2 minutes, a code called the genetic code. And that genetic code is universal, as I'll tell you about again. And that gene is transcribed into an RNA, and that RNA has this genetic code, and that genetic code is translated into a protein, which consists of amino acids. When the mutation occurs, the mutation changes the order of nucleotides in the gene. So here's the normal gene, here's the mutant gene. This is one allele, this is the second allele. Two different forms of the same gene. They only differ, Nick, by this one nucleotide pair. The change in that one nucleotide pair is collinear. This is a very important word, collinear. DNA sequences are collinear with mRNA sequences, which are collinear with protein sequences. So there's a collinearity between the gene, the messenger RNA, and the protein. And that's the process of gene expression. The gene is expressed because the sequence can be transcribed into an RNA, the RNA can be translated into a protein, and the protein represents ultimately the sequence of the gene. If you know the sequence of the protein, you can sometimes come up with the sequence of the gene. If you know the sequence of the gene, you can always come up with the sequence of the protein because of the genetic code. So we have this process of transcription and translation. And notice, because we have a mutation here, that mutation manifests itself in a mutant messenger RNA. The mutant messenger RNA leads to, because the genetic code has changed, an alteration in an amino acid. Here we have a glutamic acid. Here we have a valine. And that may change something in the protein. Nick. I know what you're going to ask, but it's going to be a good question. Go ahead. I'm anticipating.
I don't know if it's a question you're thinking, but...
It's always the questions I'm thinking about.
Just wanted to clarify, then, an allele is when there's only one base pair mutation?
It could be one base pair mutation. It could be two base pair mutations. It could be a deletion. It could be an addition. It could be a rearrangement. Anything that changes one gene from the other gene will be an allelic difference.
So how come this isn't considered a whole new gene as opposed to just
because
an allele of the same
specifies,
gene?
So alleles are just different forms of the same gene. Mm-hmm. And in order to be a whole new gene, you'd have to completely change the entire nucleotide sequence in a drastic way to get a completely new protein
right. That
would have completely different properties, like... For example, you'd have to change a gene that specifies your hair protein into a gene that specifies maybe an enzyme that would, and that's a drastic change, because now we're talking about, instead of a gene having one difference in nucleotide or a fewer, you know, minor number, we're talking about a completely different gene with no similarities whatsoever. Okay? So in order to have the gene completely changed, you have to have a completely different sequence. So here's the process of transcription and translation. And the point here is that a mutation can occur that affects transcription. Samantha, if there's a mutation in a switch that prevents the template strand from being transcribed, that leads to a very drastic mutation. If you can't transcribe that gene, you got a big mutation. There ain't any protein. That's about the most drastic you could ever have. Okay? Or if you have a mutation somewhere in the coding portion of the gene, such that it changes the code subtly, that may or may not change the protein function. It may or it may not change the protein function. It depends upon how serious it is in a change of the amino acid in the protein. There's a lot of mutations in genes that change proteins in subtle ways, Lauda, that don't have any effect, that do not have any effect in causing any mutations that we see. So some things are tolerated. But if it drastically changes the amino acid sequence and the function of the protein, and you'll see why I'm saying this in a second, you can lead to a mutation. The messenger RNA code has to be translated. It's a very specific function. These things called ribosomes, which are the machinery in the cell for translation, the biggest machinery you can imagine, very complex. If something affects the movement of this ribosome along the messenger RNA or the binding of this ribosome to the messenger RNA. That's a big mutation, Samantha. If you can't bind the ribosome to the messenger RNA may be there, but you ain't going to make a protein. That's a big mutation. Or anything that may change what brings the amino acids to this machine. Because amino acids have to be brought to the machine would cause a mutation. And a variety of different things. The point here is conceptually is you have to be able to have this process carried out faithfully, and mutations in parts of the gene that are critical for its function can lead to a loss of a protein and therefore a change in a phenotype. In order to make a protein, it takes proteins. There's 3,000 genes in the human genome that affect transcription and translation. 3,000 genes. We know that from the sequence of the human genome. And there they are. 3,000 of these genes are involved in transcription translation processes. And so if you alter those genes, you've got some very serious defects. So Chris, if you change a gene that affects the transcription of your genes, you got big problems. If you change a gene that affects the transcription of a gene, that can cause a huge problem during embryo development. You could see that, Sommer. And the embryo won't even develop. So when you mutate genes that affect the process of genes making proteins, those are the worst kinds of mutation you could ever imagine, but they're selected against because they can't produce any proteins. So those would be called lethal mutations. So any mutation that affects the organism from even developing, bacteria, animal, plant, is a lethal mutation. There's 3,000 of those. So the chance, that's 10% of the genes in the human genome, contribute to simply transcription and translation processes. So again, it's a miracle that you get a normal baby when all of these processes have to work at exactly the same time, exactly the same place, and be accurate. Juditha, general question based on what I'm referring to here. Good.
Okay. Why is it that...
Not why.
For what reason...
Thank you.
...is it that the mutation that causes cystic fibrosis or something like that wouldn't be a mutation that would stop the baby from developing? Like, why is it that that pregnancy wouldn't get terminated by the body but something else
because
would?
It's not a lethal mutation. It manifests itself after the child is born.
Okay.
So the child during gestation is really being supplied everything by the mother.
Okay.
In the womb. It's not until it gets on its own where it's manifested in a particular way. Lisa.
Can you give like an example of a disease that happens as a result of a mutation occurring on one of the 3,000?
You'd never see those diseases because they don't...
What if they occur after birth, like because of
then mutagens? They would cause cancer.
Okay.
They can have the potential to cause cancer if it was in a gene that might be involved in regulating some other genes in the extreme form. But generally, those kinds of mutations don't even make it, you know, past the fertilization stage because they're so critical. Imagine if you didn't have a gene that wouldn't allow the ability to make ribosomes, which is the factory for making
protein. The baby would be aborted.
Not even just the embryo. You don't even get a baby.
Right.
It's a one-celled embryo that stops. So you get a spontaneous abortion. And that's part of the cause of 15% of the spontaneous abortions. Half of the spontaneous abortions are due to simply mutations in these kinds of genes. The other half are due to rearrangements and stuff. We'll talk about that next week. So I can't give you an example of a disease like that because they don't happen. Go ahead. Ben, my man, how are you doing?
Good.
Never been better? Working on your DNA play? Got your roll down pretty good?
Yeah.
Practicing it?
Some.
Know about the Fry test and all that kind of good stuff? And read your article and ready to roll? Go ahead. What's your question?
Like in the pre-implantation genetic testing, they took
out... Yes, PGD.
They took out one of the 8 cells from an embryo. So
yeah.
Let's say like one of these mutations happens at that point.
You won't even get these 8 cells probably.
But, and then the other 7 are enough to live on, so why does it matter if just one of these cells has this mutation?
Well, the mutation, okay, there's 2 kinds of mutations. Okay. So you ask a really good question, Ben. So the first the first question would be, is it a mutation that occurred either in the development of the egg or the sperm? And so that means all of the 8 cells would have that mutation. On the other hand, is it a mutation that occurs spontaneously after fertilization and would not be inherited? And in that case, if by chance it occurs in one of those 8 cells, and you happen to sample the cell that it occurred in, maybe the other 7 cells would not be affected, but the probability of that happening is so infinitesimally small that it's almost zero. Because mutations, remember, occur one every million to billion times. So we have a zygote, and it's only divided 3 times. You know, once is 2 cells, twice is 4 cells, and 3 is 8 cells. So the chance of having a mutation in 3 divisions is almost zero. Okay, so that's why that wouldn't occur in that case. Lisa, you had another question. Go ahead. You did or did not? Okay, good. So we have this process of DNA to RNA to proteins. Now, what about this genetic code? The reason why the glowfish gene can be active in a human or in a monkey or in a pig is because the genetic code between the jellyfish and the mammal is universal. The reason why, as you know, the insulin gene or the insulin cDNA in humans can be expressed in a bacteria is because the genetic code is universal. But what you need to know is, and we've talked about it in here, is that the genetic code has certain properties. And the genetic code was solved in 1966. It was one of the most amazing breakthroughs there was when I graduated college that long ago, was the genetic code was cracked. A series of fascinating experiments that I don't have time to go into, but the point is there's 20 different amino acids. We've talked about this. Because there's 20 amino acids and there's 3 codons per amino acid, there's 64 different codons. So the genetic code has properties. Sam, it's universal. The genetic code for us is the same as the genetic code for E. coli. The genetic code for us is the same as the genetic code for any creature, virus, bacteria, anything on the face of this earth. That's just the way it happened. That means the genetic code is very ancient, and preceded, most likely, the development of cells and multicellularity. The genetic code has punctuation. We have not talked about this. There's a particular codon that says start at the beginning of a messenger RNA. It's a place in which the messenger RNA knows to begin the process of producing a protein. It's a specific sequence. Again, modular, Heather. It's a module, ATG. Anytime you have ATG at the beginning of a gene or a messenger RNA, it says begin to make a protein. The genetic code is degenerate, meaning there's more than one codon, Nick, for a given amino acid. And that has a lot of consequences. Meaning if you have more than one codon for a given amino acid, you can't simply use the amino acid sequence of a protein to predict the gene sequence. I'm going to say that again. If the genetic code is degenerate, you can't simply use the amino acid sequence of a protein to derive the gene sequence because you don't know which of those codons are used. And you're going to stumble onto this problem on your take-home test. And you'll stumble on this problem when I talk about hemophilia and talk about isolating human disease genes. So the point is we have a universal genetic code, we have a degenerate genetic code, we have a code that has punctuation, and it's always 3 nucleotides, always. It's just the way it was. And if you want to say, why is that or how is it, it's just the way it happened. And that's simply it. There's no other explanation for it. But this is why genetic engineering can work, because of the genetic universal code. And we know that it's universal from genetic engineering and a variety of other things, but we really know it's universal from the experiments that we went over in class. And to design an experiment to show that the genetic code is universal will be a subject of either your midterm oral exam or of your final oral exam. So the point is we have genes on chromosomes, and there they are, and we have the linear sequence of genes. There we have gene 1, gene 2, gene 3, and we have messenger RNA 1, messenger RNA 2, messenger RNA 3. We have a gene, sense strand, antisense, sense strand, antisense, sense strand, antisense, 5 prime, 3 prime, 3 prime, 5 prime, all the rules of the double helix, Everything follows from that. We have the complementary messenger RNAs, 1, 2, 3 genes. Why? Because there's a beginning and an end to each gene. How is there a beginning and an end to each gene? Because there are specific sequences that I told you about a week or so ago. There are specific sequences at the beginning of a gene, specific sequences at the end of the gene that say start transcription, end transcription, specific sequences. And then there's the genetic code in between. So even though the genes are within the same double helix and the sequence is just contiguous to each other, it's the sequences in the DNA that mark the beginning and the end of genes. And those sequences are unique. Make no mistake about it. And how do you know what those sequences are? You know from sequencing them. And you also know from comparing the sequence of one gene to another gene, because they have certain signature features that say, this is the beginning of this gene, Easter. This is the end of that gene. This is the beginning of that gene. That's the end of that gene. This is the beginning of this gene. That's the end of that gene. Why is there a beginning? Because the RNA polymerase enzyme that transcribes the template strand of that gene must bind to this strand at the beginning of the gene. Why is there a sequence that says end? Because the RNA polymerase that finishes the transcription of this gene, making those Christmas trees that I showed you, has to recognize this is the end of that strand, fall off, and another one bind to the next gene. Has to be specific sequences. There's no hocus pocus. There's no mysteries. So what I'm saying here is, Radina, if I know what those sequences are, I can construct a gene, correct? If I know what the genetic code is, I can construct a gene. So it should be obvious to you all now when I said a few weeks ago that you can synthesize genes, how you can do it. If you know the sequence of the gene you want, you just put the nucleotides together using chemistry. If you want to make the beginning of a gene, you just use the sequence for the beginning of a gene. If you want to use the end of a gene, you need the sequence to the end of the gene. And Nick, this is going to be so important for your exams, I can't even imagine that you're not writing this stuff down. It's just incredible, isn't it? Aren't you just excited as can be? What's your question?
Shouldn't we see an ATG, the beginning of those gene sequences?
The ATG is at the beginning of the part of the message that's translated. So the ATG would be in the part of the gene that's translated. And this is probably just a conceptual thing that really wasn't meant to measure reality here, okay? And the T wouldn't be on the gene, well, on the message, it would be on the gene. But yes, there would be an ATG at the beginning of the part of the message or the gene that's translated. Yes, so it would mark the beginning of where the genetic codes reads out. It's a little bit more complicated than that. I don't want to get into it. But there's these other sequences that I showed you about in the anatomy of the gene, AT, AT, AA, that marks the beginning of the gene. So we have this collinearity, one gene, one protein. Of course, I'm going to throw that out in the wastebasket in a couple seconds, but we have one gene, one protein, one trait, one specific function, mutate those particular proteins, mutate functions. Now, I haven't said anything about proteins. And I'm not going to say very much about proteins, but they carry out all the work in cells. There's all kinds of different proteins, of different hair proteins, skin proteins, enzymes, all kinds of different things. And they're all encoded by different kinds of genes. And as you'll learn and we've talked about, it's about 30,000 genes in the human genome, 5,000 genes in the bacteria E. coli genome, 50,000 genes in the corn genome, 15,000 genes in the fruit fly genome. Every organism has a different set of genes. Every organism has a different set of proteins. Karina, how come chimpanzees and humans have 99.1% of the same DNA sequences, but we're so different? What's your hypothesis for that?
The genes.
If you look at the nucleotide sequences of the chimp and the human, which have all been sequenced, there's no mysteries now. We know the DNA sequence of a chimp. We know the DNA sequence of a human being. We know the DNA sequence of a dog. We know the DNA sequence of a rat. We know the DNA sequence of a mouse. There's no mysteries anymore about how these DNA sequences relate to each other. So if we're 99% similar to a chimpanzee, how come we're different?
Well, probably because...
What's your hypothesis?
Well, I hypothesize that that 1% difference accounts for specific characteristics in humans that...
Just 1%? Talking
yeah,
about
because
1% of 3 billion nucleotides? We're talking about, you know, 10 million nucleotide differences?
Yeah, because 1% difference... Well, one gene could code for many proteins. It's not like one gene...
Say that again?
One gene codes for many proteins.
So it's not the 1% difference causes a difference in what we are and what chimps are. It might be... What might be the differences?
The genes that are different.
Genes are the same, but...
The proteins they code for
are different. The proteins they make are different. So the key is the proteins they make. So the genes are the same, but in some ways the proteins they make are different. And that's a big revelation. And that revelation is really something that was very, 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 very surprising. In other words, the set of proteins, and these are proteins, these are amino acids, which are the units of the protein, and there they are, 20 of them, all different in chemistry, things that you need to survive, things that you need to grow, things that you need to develop. There's the 20 amino acids in all proteins, and proteins differ by the kinds of amino acids they have. Daisy, they differ by the sequence of those amino acids they have. And the sequence of the amino acids and the kinds always relates to the genetic code. And that genetic code always relates to the sequence of the particular gene and the genome. And those amino acids are connected by very specific bonds that you read about in your DNA double helix book called peptide bonds. So the bond that holds amino acids together is a peptide bond. And just like RNA and DNA, a protein has a beginning and a protein has an end. And the beginning of a protein is called the N-end, the N-terminus, and the end of the protein is called the C-terminus. And that order of amino acid 1, 2, 3, 4, specifies function. But more than that, proteins have to have a shape. So the shape of proteins is much more complex than the shape of DNA or the shape of RNA. And it's the shape of the proteins which results from the sequence of the amino acids. It's the shape of the proteins that causes the functions. Radina, what can a mutation do? What can a mutation do? If we change a nucleotide in a gene, we're changing the genetic code, changing amino acid, what can happen?
The shape of the protein can change.
And therefore it won't work. It might not fit into the membrane, it might not carry out an enzymatic reaction, might not do what it's doing, but the change, what if the change doesn't? What if the change in the amino acid doesn't cause a change in shape?
Are you asking me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then it doesn't change, it doesn't cause a change in the protein, which means that it's not a mutation that's, you know,
that you'll
presenting
see.
Itself in the phenotype.
You might see it with molecular tools, but you might not see it phenotypically. So you can change the amino acid, but if it doesn't change the shape, and therefore the function of the protein has no consequences. So again, some mutations have no consequence. And how come some mutations have no consequence? Because of degeneracy in the genetic code. You can change a codon, but still code for the same amino acid. Because some codons, some amino acids have 3 or 4, 5 or 6 different codons. And so because of degeneracy in the code, Sam, you can change a gene but not change a codon significantly to change the amino acid. Therefore, you won't change the protein. So again, to get a change in a functional protein is not something that's simple, T. It's something that's rare, very rare, because of all of what I've been talking about. Okay, now, one of the surprises from the Human Genome Project, one of the big surprises, although it was known before this, it was known well before this, it was known after genes were cloned in 1976. In fact, I remember like yesterday, I was at the exact meeting that people reported the first sequence of a human gene, or of any gene. And I remember at that meeting, it was much like this room with just about as many people, that these people who did this, Tom Maniotis, it's not important to tell you the name, said that there were hunks of things in the gene that they couldn't find in the cDNA. The cDNA is the copy of the messenger RNA. The gene is the gene. And they found that there was these hunks of things in the gene that didn't exist in the messenger RNA cDNA copy. This was very surprising, extremely controversial. And in fact, at that meeting, no one believed them because they thought at those times it was an artifact of recombinant DNA because people had only used recombinant DNA for approximately 3 years. And so the question was whether it was an artifact of cloning or not. It turned out not to be. I'm not going to go into the history of those experiments, which are very much fun to talk about. But the point here is it was found that there were these things inside eukaryotic genes that do not code for proteins, which were termed introns, DNA sequences in the middle of the gene that didn't exist in the messenger RNA, and during the transcription of the messenger RNA had to be excised out by a process called splicing. And that was a big surprise, huge surprise. No one anticipated this. No one thought that this occurred. Everyone thought that the gene was indivisible, one coding length, but clearly that was not the case. Radina?
What is the reason for
there is
which...
no reason.
Is there a
There's
theory?
No reason. I'm not... There's no reason.
But you don't know what I'm going to ask.
I know what you're going to ask, so go ahead.
Really? Okay. What is the reason for which humans... have so few proteins, I mean, excuse me, so many fewer genes than mice, and they code for
I didn't
proteins.
Say that. Mice and humans have the same number of genes.
I mean...
The mouse and a human have about the same number of genes.
Okay, never mind.
The mouse and the fly have different genes. A corn plant has more genes than you do. Twice the number of genes. So sometimes the number of genes is not a predictor of how complicated an organism is. And that's one of the big surprises. One of the big surprises and dilemmas was what could cause differences in the complexity of an organism when there doesn't seem to be any differences in the number of genes those organisms have? And the answer lies in how many proteins they make and the kinds of proteins they make. And one of the big surprises from the Human Genome Project and other genome projects were is that one gene could make many different proteins. Not all the time, not most of the time, but some of the time. And that could be very significant. In fact, at least 15 to 20% of human genes can make more than one protein. Hold your question. Want to finish this? Okay? So we have introns in genes, and those introns have to be spliced out because they don't contain, so far as we can see, in most cases, the genetic code, and they are spliced out. And again, they're spliced out because there are specific sequences, again, saying where this splicing reaction can go. There are those sequences. There's no mysteries. Does that mean, Samantha, that I could construct, if I wanted, an intron in a gene and get its transcript spliced out by genetic engineering? If I wanted to put an intron in a synthetic gene, I could put it in there if I wanted to and get that intron spliced out in the messenger RNA if I know what these sequences are. Would you agree?
If you knew what characteristic of the intron would get it spliced out.
And there it is, right over there. Here's the beginning of the intron, here's the end of the intron. Exactly the same sequences all the time. Again, nothing occurs by chance. Everything in a cell occurs because of DNA sequences, because of protein sequences. These DNA sequences recognize a specific protein, like a scissors. And that protein causes whatever is between this GT and that AG in this transcript of the template strand of the gene to be clipped out. Kyle, can I do that synthetically? Just engineer it.
Like engineer an intron that would
Yeah,
be
engineer an intron.
If you know the sequence, yeah.
Absolutely. Again, the rule is modules. This is another Lego in your kit. We have Legos for the codons. We have Legos for the start of transcription. We have Legos for the end of transcription. We have Legos for the parts between the exon and the intron, the splice junctions, to get these things out. We have Legos for the switches that say liver and kidney, heart and skin. It's all specific sequences. We have bigger Legos that say skin protein, hair protein, heart protein, muscle protein. That's a whole gene or messenger RNA. There's no mysteries here. There's nothing. When our ancestors were selecting for crops and selecting for the cauliflower and the broccoli and the kale, they were selecting for things that affected these processes. Wasn't any magic wand or spirits or whatever. We're talking about simply sequences. You know those sequences, you can do anything you want. Anything. Because it's all modular. Now, as we said in the article I gave you, some genes in the human genome and other genomes, and I'm going to finish this in a second, some genes have many, many, many introns. In fact, the average size of a gene in the human genome, as you will learn, is 20, 30, 40,000, 50, a million base pairs in length. Some of your genes, Lisa, are 10 million base pairs in length. The size of the messenger RNA from that gene might only be 1,000, which means the vast majority of the gene is introns, not exons. Meaning the human genome has genes that are huge, but the coding sequences in those genes are tiny. And if you don't think that that was a problem for the Human Genome Project, trying to sort out which genes were which, it was. Because when you have these huge genes with little tiny coding sequences of 200 and 300 and introns that are 1 million, 3 million, 50 million base pairs in length, that's a huge bioinformatics process. But the point is we can have lots of introns in a gene, and therefore we can have alternative splices. And that splicing problem of which exons become exons and which introns become introns is a regulated process. So for this particular gene, we have a particular message for the muscle, another particular message for the skin, another particular message for the liver, another particular message for the brain. We now have one gene that makes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different proteins, all different functions. So, in fact, you could mutate this gene in one position and give rise to mutations that affect this gene in 5 different places. Or you can have a mutation in this gene in one position that might only affect its function in the fibroblast, skin cell. The point here is it's much more complicated. And so it's the functional proteins that count, not necessarily the genes. And the more functional proteins you have, it means that if we have 30,000 genes, we might be able to have hundreds of thousands of proteins. And those hundreds of thousands of proteins can cause a lot of different functions. And that's because of alternative splicing, one gene, many proteins. Now, I promised you, and I'm going to give you a break in a second, that I tell you something pretty spectacular. Alternative splicing, meaning one gene, many proteins, can cause the difference in producing a protein that works in the muscle or a function in the brain or whatever. Again, most of the protein is the same, but there's little parts of it that are different. Most of the protein is the same, but there's little parts of it that are different. Because you're now putting exons together in different combinations, or, as you asked last week, in some cases you might use an intron as an exon for a particular messenger RNA. So you can have all different combinations that lead to different functions. Well, there happens to be a gene, I won't go into why it was named, what it was named, but the most unpolitically correct name that there ever could be in the 60s, but I won't go into the whole story because it probably wouldn't be named that gene now. But there's a gene in fruit flies called FRU. I'm going to be very unpolitically correct because I did not name this gene, and I don't even work with this stuff, so I have to give you a disclaimer, but it was named the fruity gene when it was discovered in the 60s because it was a mutation in males that caused male courtship in fruit flies to be altered so that males would mate with males, but also mate with females, but also mate with males. A specific gene in a specific mutation in a specific mutation. It's now called fruitless. Name has been changed for obvious reasons. But the point here is that we have one gene that affects the behavior, courtship behavior of a fly. Well, it just so happens that that gene is active both in males and in females in flies. And it just so happens that the reason why the gene works differently in males and females is because the gene is spliced one way in males and a different way in females. And so just recently, someone changed this gene in females so that the splice variant that works in males was engineered. I'm now talking about making the alternative form of a protein that is only made in males and not made in females and is involved in male courtship and changing one nucleotide to change one splice to make one different protein from the same gene that functions in males and females now allows females to have a male courtship dance and to mate with females. One nucleotide completely alters the behavior of a complex animal. Now, our behavior, our sexual behavior, our mating behavior, infinitely more complicated than this. Infinitely more complicated. Yes, we have genes that are related to this fruitless gene, but we don't know what they do. And I'm not trying to make any analogies here. But what I'm trying to say is that in some respects, engineering a fly to have an altered behavior is much more spectacular than engineering a fly to have eyes on their legs. Because now we've taken one nucleotide and we've genetically engineered a complicated animal and its entire behavioral pattern has been altered. That's pretty spectacular use of genetic engineering. And I'm talking about, to all of you, one nucleotide. We're engineering a gene. We're making it the sequence that we want. The sequence that we want of this gene now is one that would operate to make and cause a male courtship behavior, male mating on females. We now take that gene, we insert it into females by genetic engineering, by transformation, using the word that Griffith invented, and we now take that female and it only mates with females through exactly the same dance. So not only can we genetically engineer the body form of an animal, we can genetically engineer, in this simple case, the behavior. And that's spectacular. And the reason why we can do this, and I'm going to break now, the reason why we can do this is for one reason and one reason only. It's because of the fact that all of this stuff is modular. It's modular. And it's because we know what those modules are. We know what these modules are. We know what these modules do. We know what these genes are now. We know what the modules are that control the activity of those genes. And once you know that, Dave, anything becomes possible. You're just limited by your imagination. Now, these are fruit flies. But what if I told you this was done in mice? other kinds of behaviors, not this kind of behavior, but other kinds of behavior using genetic engineering. That's pretty close, isn't it, Samantha? The point here is that one asked me a few weeks ago about whether we could understand consciousness, and I would say absolutely. Because if you understand the genes that make up your nervous system and you know how they work, you can start altering these different kinds of things. I'm not saying we should do it. I'm not saying that we will do it. I'm not saying that we'll go in that direction. All I'm saying is the following. Genes function because of specific processes in cells. Genes do not function randomly. When someone says that a genetically engineered organism is going against nature, all of you should be able to counteract that critically, because there's nothing more natural than these processes. Nothing is being changed. It's just altering the way in which cells' information is being used. And that's what engineering is about. It's no different than engineering a house, a building, a car, a light bulb, a computer. We use our knowledge of science to put things together for presumably the betterment of humanity. And the betterment of humanity, Sam, is something that we need to decide collectively on what that is. And as you'll read in a little article that I Xeroxed specifically for you, scientists are people just like you and are part of humanity and have the same kinds of thoughts and same kinds of feelings. So we're all part of the same community. One more final sentence, then we'll take a break and gather back. I find it absolutely amazing when I go running at night, or sometimes, that it was only 100 years ago that Mendel's laws were rediscovered. 100 years, it's nothing. It's nothing. And now we can engineer behavior in an animal directly, mating behavior. Or we can engineer the architecture of an animal directly. 100 years. And science is increasing exponentially. Think about the possibilities over the next 1,000 years. Everything that you know about in this room from a biological point of view, 1,000 years from now, will be considered by the people that come after us to be absolutely primitive. Just as primitive as what you consider people who lived 1,000 years ago in the way in which they lived. Only it'll be even more so because of this. This is a biological revolution from which there's no turning back. And therefore, that's why the decisions will have to be made in terms of how to go forward in a very deliberate way. But they will go forward. No one will stop this. It is impossible. Just as if you can't stop the light bulb, the computer, or anything else. Let's take a break and come back and talk about your take-home test. And by the way, when you go out, all of you take some candy because it's Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day. Dig in. That's from Gloria, Mike, and myself. I'd like you to come back in 4 minutes. Sometimes.
On Sunday was Darwin's 197th birthday. Oh. So they had an article about the relationship between faith and
economic future. A report by National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering. Chaired by two senators and members of the National Academy of Sciences, a report that's going to President Bush, but part of his competitive profile. I'm not going to, in his State of the Union speech. Yes, I know we've been talking about this for decades, but it is a big crisis. This is a 500-page report by the Academy. It's a very serious, it's a very thoughtful report. We discussed it at length at the meeting I was at 2 weekends ago in Irvine, and it's something which is The reason I'm calling it to your attention is that if you want to have a prosperous life, and if you want your children and grandchildren to have a prosperous life, it's only one thing we got going for us. We ain't manufacturing anything. We ain't doing anything. We've got science and technology. And if that goes by the wayside, we got a really serious problem. Now, you may say, well, it's not my problem, but I will tell you it is your problem because it's your standard of living. That's the bottom line. Not that we should have a monopoly on all this, quite the contrary. But if you want your standard of living to be dramatically reduced, and it will be, we cannot fall behind in science and technology. And I can give you a lot of reasons why we're falling behind in science and technology. I think a lot of it has to do with teaching, and I think a lot of it has to do with the way you guys learn about science. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we pay teachers in elementary school and high school. My niece is a teacher. She quit a $250,000 advertising a year job to go back and be a teacher. She teaches 6th grade in the Denver City school system. She makes $29,000 a year with almost the equivalent of a PhD. That's a crisis because you can't live on $29,000 a year and have a happy life. It's tough. So that's part of the crisis in attracting people because it's a little bit more lucrative to go into, you know, financing and become a banker and do all this kind of stuff and make lots of money. But something's got to be done to rectify the situation or we're going to be in bad shape. So that's an Academy report. It's very simple. It's just recommendations on what to do. I'm not going to go into it. But then those of you who get Time Magazine will also see the same thing. Is America flunking science? And the answer is clearly yes. There's just no question about that. It's, I think, worse than when I was your age, just after the time of Sputnik, and frankly went into science because of this problem and because of the money that I got to go to college because I wanted to go into science. But I think that, again, it is a crisis. And I think, again, if you look at any of these charts, you'll see dramatic dips in our production of scientists and engineers. A lot of this has to do with very complex problems that I'm not going to go into. If you read the Academy report, which is the most thoughtful report that you can read, you'll see some of the reasons for it. But again, not that I'm asking any of you to switch into science, quite the contrary. Our standard of living depends upon the fact that we have to have a competitive science and technology. It drives everything. Drives absolutely everything. And, you know, part of the things that you can imagine is like the space race and spin-offs and all these other things. But if you read this article and you just look at a few of the things that came out and started companies, how about the whole biotechnology industry? It started here in the U.S. If you look at all the Nobel laureates, vast majority of them in the U.S. Not that we should have a monopoly on anything, but we've got to keep up our competitive edge. And that's why I am delivering copies of these things to you. And then there's another one which I found, which is called Your Mind, Learn to Think Like a Scientist, which is hopefully what I'm teaching you. And this was in U.S. News and World Report. And that is how valuable thinking critically, hypothesis, always asking for alternative explanations is in anything that you do. And then I got another one for you for Sam's always talking about social responsibility, and there it is, The Case for Social Responsibility in Science, written by John Beckwith. I should editorialize and say that in the 70s, when people were protesting against genetic engineering and didn't want genetic engineering to go forward, and all the things you read about in your Scientific American article for the first week of class, he was leading the charge. And so I have to say that he's always been involved in these kinds of things, for better or for worse, and I'll let you make up your mind whether you think it's for better or for worse. And there's probably a few other handouts I'm giving you, but I can't remember what it is. Okay. Next quarter, we have this fascinating, exciting, novel, unique, research experience, which will go on in my laboratory, which is in a laboratory which was built simply for you, and that's called HC70AL2006 Gene Discovery Laboratory. This is a pretty exciting and pretty novel proposition because it's a laboratory in which all of you have a chance to have your own original project. It's not a laboratory like a laboratory. This is a laboratory where you do your own thing on something that hadn't been worked on ever before. And if you have a chance of finding something, you'll find something that no one ever found before. Is it unique, Mike?
Very much so.
Exciting? Did you learn a lot in it? Gloria, as a non-science person, did you learn a lot?
Yes.
I was going to show a film with your face in it today, but I decided I didn't have enough time.
Thank you.
Exactly. I knew you'd tell me that. That's why I decided not to do it. The point here is that it's a very novel. There, I will say, and I'm just going to be very frank about this, because it's a family here. There is not one lab like this in the United States. It's the only one that exists, where students who are not science majors can come in and do original research just like a senior molecular biology or a graduate student. This is pretty sophisticated stuff, but it's a lot of fun. And so I can take at the most 12 of you, because that's all the room that I have for, in the lab that was built. The lab was built by UCLA. They gave me a few $100,000 to build a lab that has all the equipment that you could ever imagine. Did you ever lack for any equipment when you were in that lab? You had more than most graduate students have in their labs. And did you have all the reagents and everything? Not lacking for anything. Computers, programs, PCR machines, reagents, everything that you could ever want to do real work. This is real life research designed to give entering life science students, those of you that haven't had life sciences 3 or 4, and most of you who are non-science, it's an experience that you'll never forget, ever. And so if you're interested in doing this, which I urge you, you can go to this website and you'll see all the goodies that we do, but I'd like you to send me an email indicating that you would like to take this lab. And the people who are selected for this lab are not selected on the basis of grades, performance, or anything else. Selected on the basis of interest, demographics, area, majors, all of these different things factor in. But the first part of the process is to email me and tell me that you'd like to take this lab. It's a commitment. It's a commitment. This is a really intense experience. But I will say you'll get something out of this lab that you'll never have a chance to get anywhere. It is that unique in terms of what you take away. Would you say that that's fair, Gloria? Fair, Mike? It's very unique. It's probably the most unique undergraduate experience any non-science student could ever have, because it's not one of these boring, horrible kinds of labs you had in high school or here at UCLA. This is cutting-edge, original, never been discovered before, 21st century genomics. Everything that you read about and learn about in this class, you'll have a chance to do in this laboratory. And so the kinds of things you do are in this slide, and I'm not going to go over it. That was not my intent. I was actually going to show you a film that I'm not going to show you, but it starts with a gene that you have that no one worked on in the entire world. So you work on a gene that was never worked on before by anybody. It's your own gene. You use bioinformatics to characterize this gene. Then you look for mutations in this gene. It's genes that are presumably involved in how to make seeds, which is what we work on in my lab. You'll be working alongside graduate students and postdocs. You'll be then working on this gene to find mutations and find out if those mutations have any effect on how that gene functions. You'll be sequencing that gene. There it is. You'll be doing all kinds of bioinformatics stuff. You'll be looking to see where this gene is active. You'll be using microarrays or at least microarray data. You'll be growing your own plants. And in fact, you'll have a second gene. It won't be just one gene. You'll have two genes that you'll be able to work on and do microscopy and all kinds of things. And at the end of the quarter, you'll actually give a presentation with your own data at a symposium that we have. And again, there's nothing like it, and it's, of course, sponsored by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and we're lucky to be able to have the funds to be able to do it. So, again, please email me today or tomorrow. In general, the response from all of this class has been overwhelming. In the past, mostly 90% of all the kids in all this in HC70A have wanted to participate, and I haven't been able to choose all of them, but hopefully 10 to 12 of you want to do it. There's been about 35 students that have gone through this lab, and we've knocked out, that is, created mutations in unknown genes in about 65 genes. So it's pretty significant in terms of doing original work. And so it's very much fun and very exciting. There it is. Take-home exam. You have the take-home exam handed out today. You have a file that Jessica has already uploaded on Blackboard. She has it. It's uploaded. You can download an actual Word file if you want to use a computer to type on your take-home exam. You can. It's going to go out when you leave the room. The questions are due. I'm giving you an extra couple days. They're due Thursday the 2nd of March. And on Thursday the 2nd of March, you'll have what we call midterm oral exam, where you'll have to answer questions on that exam. And there's a fail-safe system. And the fail-safe system is very simple. I'm not going to elaborate on it now. But if I have your exam and you get up with your little group, because it'll be a group exam, you won't be by yourself, and you can't answer the question that you wrote on your exam, then you don't get any points for the question on that exam. That's fair. Since you know what the question is and you're working on it and it's a take-home, I expect all of you to be able to answer those questions in front of the class. And the fail-safe system is that if you can't answer the question, then it's not fair for me to give you the points for that question. That's basically what it is. In reality, my fail-safe system for my major classes, which would be Life Sciences 3 or upper division, I do the same kind of thing, and I have a fail-safe system. But in that system, if someone gets 100% on their take-home question, but then they're not able to answer that question either orally or written after that, I mean the exact same question, then they lose the points for that question, they lose the points for the additional question, they get penalized 25% of the total points. Needless to say, no one gets less than 100% on their take-home test. No one gets less than 100% on their oral or their final midterms. It's a good catalyst. I've used it for many years. And you're kind of using it in your quizzes and stuff, so you're used to it. Again, I'm not going to take extra points away from you, but when you sign that thing, I expect that you understand it and that you can answer it. And when you have this midterm oral, last year was spectacular. It's absolutely spectacular, to say the least, in the year before. So I expect you to be able to answer these questions, but in a group. And I'll talk more about that. None of you will be put on the spot on your own. None of you. Okay. Tomorrow's your law school. It's up here. It's across from Murphy Hall. If you do your little play that enacts the murder, please do it outside, not in the law school, as I discussed. You'll have a little map of where that is. We talked about that. For the text reading, there it is. I don't have to go over that. You have these handouts. Please read this article on the molecular genetics of hemophilia, which will be the subject perhaps of the next lecture. You have your genes, your choices, which I handed out last time, which is ethical issues in human genetics, and it will relate to this. You have this, which I gave you a few weeks ago, genomes.org, ethical issues in the Human Genome Project, and then these things that I'm giving you today. What else do I have? We talked about all of that today, and that's it. Do you have any questions before you go? Okay, so do me a favor. It's a lot of stuff to hand out. Are they in packets? What is this? How do you want to do this? Do you have the take-home in a packet? They're all in packets?
They're all in packets.
Okay, so hold on. To make this a little bit more orderly, you'll be given a packet by either Mike or Gloria. And in that packet contains everything that you need, including your take-home test. So just grab one of those as you leave. And I'll see you tomorrow in the law school.
Everybody in Gloria's section has time to speed out in the accepting patio area with like 5 minutes.
can't hear you, Regina.
What